This is High Country Views, news for people who care about the West. I'm Callie Carswell. In early September, embers from a fire pit in Four Mile Canyon, in the foothills around Boulder, Colorado, ignited the most damaging wildfire in the state's history. Not in terms of acres burned, but in terms of the number of homes lost. Nearly 170 across some 6,400 acres. Cale Casey, a resident of Paonia, Colorado, where High Country News is based, worked the fire as an EMT paramedic. So, Cale, you live here in Paonia in western Colorado, which is about 5 hours from Boulder. So when you got the call from dispatch and were on your way over, what was going through your mind? What were you preparing yourself for?
The reports had already come out that this was the singular most destructive fire probably in Colorado's history. And firefighters who we know and work with had already lost their houses. So in particular, one gentleman who's a fire behavior analyst and just a heck of a great guy, we knew he watched his house burn. So the emotions were already running high. And Colorado has a huge number of dedicated incident management people and hotshot crews and firefighters who really, really care about where we live. So being one of those and being on the way over, you're thinking, how can I get my job done but also keep myself safe? Because the inferno is something that it really can't be dealt with on a rational level.
At the point you arrived, what stage was the fire at? And can you just kind of describe the scene for us as far as the mood of the crew, what it looked like, what it smelled like?
Sure. So most resources were dispatched the day after Labor Day. It takes a little while for the command staff to get in place. It started with a Type 3 team out of Boulder, and the Type 3 team is like your regional team. And Boulder is a really talented group. They know what they're doing, but this was a huge burn. So they immediately upgraded it to a Type 2 team, and then that immediately got upgraded to the highest level team, which is a Type 1 team. So Type 1 teams roll with about 70 incident management people, and it's a buzzing place when that happens. There's trailers being ordered and communication units coming in and all kinds of hotshot crews, engines, helicopters, air operation, air tankers, helitankers. It's just a total zoo. And especially when you've already lost that many houses, people are really running fast and they're amped up.
So this fire was happening in something that's called the Wildland Urban Interface, which is basically a kind of borderland where public land meets relatively dense private development. So for the fire crew, what were the unique challenges that came with fighting this fire in such a densely populated area? And what kind of decisions are you guys making as you fight it?
The fire burned a little bit of everything, but not all of everything. So we were on a Rio Chico Road and Four Mile Canyon Road. This was the interior division, which is where I was working as a line medic. And our job was to secure the line interior. What that means is you're chasing this burn line that went up and down different canyons, around houses, through houses, near houses, everywhere which way, had to have a line, which is about a foot or two wide scraped area where there's no more vegetation. That's what we call line. When we talk about digging line, it was extremely complicated to figure out where the line was because it's everywhere. It was around so many different drainages and features that the crews pretty much spent the first 2 days just trying to identify where the heck all the line needed to go. The perimeter crews on the outside of the fire were working their tail off just trying to keep the heat. So the whole thing, this was a very complicated event, which is why it immediately went from a Type 3 event to a Type 2 event to a Type 1 event with the potential to blow up and threaten Boulder.
So, Cale, shortly after the Four Mile Canyon fire was quelled, you were deployed about 35 miles north of Boulder to Loveland to fight another fire that was threatening homes. What was that transition and second experience like?
Now, Loveland Fire was much smaller. It was only 600 acres, but it had burned a couple houses, and the conditions were still very hot and dry, and the political tensions were very, very high with a national spotlight on Boulder, that they took no chances and basically sent the resources from Four Mile up to Loveland to this very small fire and basically just hammered it. And they just wanted to make sure that there was no more growth of this fire than there needed to be. There were no resource objectives. Like sometimes we fight a big fire and we let a certain area of it burn because it helps a resource objective, like thinning trees in an area that nobody has houses. But with these fires, when they get really political, the goal is to completely crush them. And they pretty much just washed the mountain away with water with the helicopters that they had from the Four Mile. I've never seen more resources on one fire than anywhere I've ever been. So we overwhelmed it.
So after fighting a big fire like this, I imagine when you get home, it kind of stays with you for a while.
Well, what you remember more than anything else is that when you leave to go get your paperwork done and drive home, the people whose houses you've been watching and sort of observing as a witness, they're going to see that for the first time. So I got in on day two of the fire, and I was up in houses in Arroyo Chico with amazing views that were still smoldering, completely devastated, everything around them, their cars, their greenhouses, their trampolines. I was able to see that and kind of process it days and days and days before the residents were able to even know what their place looked like. And you come home to your little community, your beautiful hamlet here, and we look around and say, God, look at all of our neighbors don't have to go through that right now. Not to say that we'll never go through that. There's actually the potential for every little town to have a wake-up call where the conditions get just right. There's so much work to be redone if you're going to rebuild up there. That I just finished my house in June, waiting 15 years to build it. The heartbreak that the people must feel is what you carry with you, because there's nothing you can say. What are you going to say?
County, state, and federal officials will likely have plenty to say, though, in the coming months and years, especially when it comes to how people living in the mountains can better protect themselves from fire when they rebuild. Fire mitigation around residential development has been a big issue in Boulder County for years. The county has the most developed wildland-urban interface in Colorado and the 10th most developed in the West. A fire like the Four Mile was not unexpected there. After the Black Tiger Fire destroyed more than 40 homes in the late 80s, the county formed a wildfire mitigation group, which coordinates the mitigation efforts of local, state, and federal officials and private landowners. Eric Phillips heads that group. So, Eric, what are some of the things Boulder County has been doing over the last couple of decades to shield itself from fire?
Well, two main things that we can discuss. One is building codes, creation of things like the Urban Wildland Interface Code, defensible space, proper siting of a house location, creation of adequate emergency access, emergency water supply for those structures, and the overall maintenance of the site for forest health purposes. That is mandated as part of building code regulations for new structures in Boulder County. There's also an effort in part cooperatively to do basically fuel breaks, we call them, on multiple properties, both private and public, around existing subdivisions. And that is a multidisciplinary practice being done by agencies like Boulder County, the Colorado State Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service, BLM, and also the private landowners themselves and the fire protection districts that those landowners pay taxes to.
So just for any fire neophytes out there, can you tell us what a defensible space is?
Defensible space is a concept that came out of some of the fires here in California. It's an area that firefighters can work in. Firefighters do not attack crown fires, that is, fire in the trees. The intensity is too high, and as much as you see the air tankers dropping retardant on trees, usually that's most effective when it's tied into an area of low fuels, meaning areas that have grasses, openings in them. Those are the kinds of things that we're looking at for homes as well. We want an area surrounding the house that's low vegetation, well-maintained, a few individual trees, not a dense stand of forest that the house is just pushed into. Of course, people, you know, they look at things from an aesthetic point of view. They liked having their house right in the forest. We try to balance that.
As you guys are looking at the aftermath of the fire, what have you learned so far about how much of a safeguard defensible spaces are when a fire is moving as hot and fast as the Four Mile Fire was?
I've looked at the sites up there. Generally, what I've seen is that the sites that had good defensible space, proper building materials and access and those sorts of things, they did fairly well in the fire. A lot of the structures that we've seen that had burned down were structures that were built prior to those codes being in place or had been built early on and maybe didn't have quite the level of defensibility as some of our more recent structures. Well, in defensible space and fire mitigation in general is really designed on sort of a normal circumstances. This was an extreme fire under difficult conditions with the wind blowing it. At that point, all bets are off, and certain places fared fine, other places did not. All it takes sometimes is a small chink in the armor of the house. Somebody left a window open or a patio cushion on a chair, or maybe had a wood deck, for example, which was allowed years ago. And the number of places just hadn't gotten to the point where they had completed all their work before this fire hit.
Are there things you can identify at that point, at this point already, where you could say there's more that could be done to mitigate the impacts of these kind of events, particularly on private land? Or are fires like this at some point just inevitable if development keeps pushing into the forest?
Well, the fires are inevitable in the sense that that's part of the natural tone of the ecosystems. That the fires do happen in our western areas. It's just something that the people need to be aware of as they build homes in here. That's why we try to have these codes. And we are doing the best we can to educate those folks as people move into these areas. People who've lived in these areas for a long time, we try to get them to comply with these requirements as well. But we have no mandate to retroactively enforce. Even so, we have what I like to refer to as a chronic versus acute problem. We have homeowners who are very close to one another with their homes. They want to keep the trees for screening between them and their neighbors. They're really just not willing to do the level of defensible space work that might be required. But the acute problem that they deal with is when we have a wildfire like this, then there's a risk that their house is going to just burn down. And so it's a balancing act at that point. We can't just go in and tell people what to do because they'll just turn you off and walk away. That's not a good way of doing things. We have to get buy-in from those landowners. It's an ongoing process. Fires do happen, and this one happened to happen at a time when, you know, we've had some work in progress. I mean, we had a number of fuel breaks that were in progress when this fire happened. And like I said, some of those areas did really well. Other areas burned through very quickly because we hadn't completed our defensible space and our fire fuel break work. So it's going to happen. It's just a matter of, you know, trying to keep up with the curve, so to speak, of the development that happens in the mountains.
So in the immediate aftermath of the fire, what has your work involved, and what kind of questions will you guys be looking to answer in the coming months?
Well, what we're seeing right now is, you know, obviously that people are kind of in shock from losing homes and or seeing the change in the ecosystem and the change in the landscape that they've witnessed. So once we get past that, there are more pertinent questions about how do I rebuild? What's it going to look like? Where can I plant trees? What do I do with the trees that are dead on my property? How can I revegetate? We are actively working on answering those questions for people, giving people advice and proper information. We have an emergency rehabilitation team that's being put together to look at some of those areas to see if there's something that the county can do and even the state on a cooperative, collaborative method to make sure that those areas get rehabilitated properly. But there's a lot of private landowner that's up in these areas that's going to need to be done by private landowners, and we just want to make sure that they get the best practice information possible.
Do you know of anyone who's planning not to rebuild?
The experience has been from other fires that there is a certain percentage of people who will just say, I'm done with this, I'm going to walk away, and I'm not going to rebuild. There are still areas in the Black Tiger Fire burn area. There's still foundations up there from years ago when the Black Tiger Fire happened. People have not rebuilt on them. A lot of people who, you know, are able to rebuild will do so. And so we're just hoping to make sure that when they do rebuild, obviously they have to meet the current standards for rebuilding. We're going to try to work with them on that because a lot of these people may not necessarily understand what that's all about. They may have had a home that has been up there for 50 years or more. We're trying to be sensitive to their needs and work with them through our process as best we can. Obviously, like I said before, they're in a state of shock about this. And we have to just work with them on a one-on-one basis to get them back into their homes.
This has been a production of High Country News, a nonprofit covering the important stories and issues that define the American West. Our magazine prints 22 times a year, and you can find us online at hcn.org.